This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Transition management, succession planning, legacy optimization. These phrases have slipped into our vocabulary from the worlds of business and politics. They are, no doubt, ugly snippets of jargon, but behind them lies a recurrent problem in human affairs. Success is so difficult to maintain beyond the lifetime of a great leader. In many ways, the early Muslim community was remarkably good at transition management. After the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632, the Muslim territory expanded as armies made unprecedented military gains west across North Africa and into Spain, and east into Central Asia and India, and north to the edge of Europe. This remarkable story of conquest might give the impression of Islam as a unified force sweeping across the known world, but this would be a distortion. From the time of the Prophet's death, through the centuries and up to today, Muslims have debated issues of theology and politics, creating competing sects and movements. These differences have led to wars and inquisitions, where Muslims have fought each other and died. And perhaps the most persistent and chronic split has been between Sunni and Shi'i interpretations of the faith. The origins of this division can be traced to the succession planning of the Prophet himself. Did he designate a successor? And if he did, on which of his companions did he bestow this honour? Sunni Muslims eventually came to the conclusion that Muhammad did not designate a successor. He showed the qualities of a leader, and he identified these talents in different companions at different times. But he was content to allow the elders of the community to select the next leader. And in their wisdom, some gave their oath of allegiance to the Prophet's trustworthy friend and long-time companion, Abu Bakr, whose daughter, Aisha, had held the exalted position of being one of the Prophet's wives. There was, though, an alternative view, one which was pushed aside by the elders, that the Prophet had indeed designated a successor, and this person was more worthy of the community's allegiance. Ali, Muhammad's cousin, son of his uncle Abu Talib, had known the Prophet all his life, had grown up with Muhammad like a brother when Abu Talib took in the orphaned Prophet. Ali had accepted Islam in its earliest days, had stayed loyal to the cause, and had been a close confidant of the Prophet. It was, his supporters claimed, obvious that he was the designated successor. Had not the Prophet himself said, "Whoever takes me as a guide, takes Ali as such also"? The party of Ali, Shi'at Ali, or Shia for short, campaigned for his rightful position as leader. The injustice done to Ali, son of Abu Talib, by the selection of Abu Bakr defined the Shi'i cause and continues to define it today. There are many different Shi'i groups, and they have disagreed, sometimes violently, but the adherence to the validity of Ali's claim to leadership unites them. Ali's justice, his honesty, his moral goodness, his incorruptibility, his bravery in defence of Islam, his care for the unity of the community, these qualities, for the Shia, demonstrate why the Prophet designated him as their next leader, and why the Prophet gave him his daughter Fatima's hand in marriage. For many Shia, this union, blessed by the Prophet himself, elevates the offspring of Fatima and Ali, the household of the Prophet, to be the natural, proper leaders of the Muslim community. And the history of Islam, from the Prophet's death to today, is, for the Shia, one of usurpation, when that rightful leadership is denied. For the Shia, the descendants of Ali are the true imams, the guides of the community. The oppression of the Shia began with the theft of the Prophet's legacy by Abu Bakr and his supporters. It's not so easy to disentangle the person of Ali, son of Abu Talib, from the myth. He's recognized as a good, pious and upright Muslim by all. For Sunnis, he is the fourth of the rightly guided caliphs. In Sufism, the mystical tradition of Islamic thought, Ali is often seen as the initiator of meditative and contemplative practices. The sayings attributed to him portray him as a deeply moral and spiritual believer. He viewed this world as transient compared to the eternal company of God in paradise. Of all the mistakes a man can make, love of this world is the greatest, he said. Every breath brings one closer to death. Ali advocated a deep inner contemplative life, saying, "He who knows himself knows God." He argued that every believer's action should be infused with moral purpose. Each person's behaviour reveals the state of his mind. One is judged by the purity of one's intentions. He emphasised knowledge over ignorance and the rejection of tyranny. The tyrant's success is, in fact, his moral failure, he said. And his ideal of leadership was one where justice and peace were the ultimate aims of politics. For the Shia, though, he is more than simply a trustworthy companion of the Prophet. He is the first imam after the Prophet himself. And they have turned to him and his words for guidance through the centuries. Interpretations of his significance may vary, but we can sketch out the bare facts of his life. He grew up with the Prophet, knew him intimately, and perhaps he did consider himself chosen to lead. But if he did, he did not rebel when the community followed someone else. The Shia point to this refusal to openly condemn the other caliphs as signs of both his forbearance and his devotion to the cause. Of course, he could have challenged them, so the argument goes, but he recognised that the community needed unity following the demise of their beloved leader. This was not the time to start a civil war, even if his cause was just. And so, for 22 years, he remained quiet, participating in politics when he saw it as necessary, withdrawing when appropriate. And when the third caliph, Uthman, was murdered by rebels in 656, he had, in the minds of the political elite, positioned himself as the natural successor, receiving the oath of allegiance. At last, his supporters felt, justice had been done. Ali had had legitimacy but no power. For the Shia, the brief 5-year period of Ali's caliphate was the only time after the Prophet's death when legitimacy and power were exercised together. How Ali reacted to his selection as caliph was to dictate his period in power. The relatives of the murdered Caliph Uthman were keen to see the rebels punished for killing a rightful caliph. And though he may not have approved of their methods, Ali owed his rise to power directly to the forces that had led to Uthman's demise. It was not so easy for him to simply punish the offenders, and his lack of decisive action led to resistance and rebellions. The first opposition was from Aisha, Abu Bakr's daughter and a much-loved wife of the Prophet. There had always been a tension between Ali and Aisha. There may have been competition for the Prophet's affections, and Ali had publicly reprimanded her in the past. She set herself up in the sanctuary in Mecca in protest at Ali's election to the caliphate. Gradually, she gathered around her a bevy of malcontents who were prepared to challenge Ali's leadership. Ali faced other problems outside of the Arabian Peninsula in the newly conquered territories. Ali's predecessor caliphs had appointed relatives and cronies as governors in the provinces. They were less than impressed with Ali's election as caliph, and even more incensed by his failure to seek justice against the murderers of Uthman. For the rest of his caliphate, Ali had to deal with these various rebels, and any aspirations he had for a legacy were swamped in the business of staying in power. First, he had to face Aisha and her two supporters, Talha and Azubair. These two had been companions of the Prophet, and so held a special position in the early Muslim community. Their rebellion was, then, a serious threat. The three set out from Mecca to gather supporters in Iraq, and Ali realised he had to challenge them before more people joined the revolt. The three established themselves in Basra, today in southern Iraq. As Ali advanced, the coalition began to crumble, until only Aisha was left. Her followers fought valiantly, with her in the thick of the fighting, seated upon her camel. A woman's presence on the battlefield was remarkable in itself. A wife of the Prophet even more so. In the end, she never managed to acquire sufficient forces to seriously undermine Ali's leadership. But after her defeat, she was sent back to Arabia to a life of teaching and seclusion. A more significant threat to Ali was to come from the north. When Uthman was caliph, he had appointed a relative named Muawiyah as governor of Syria. This man, aggrieved at Uthman's murder, rejected Ali's claim to the caliphate. The two traded emissaries, each refusing the demands of the other, and conflict became inevitable. Both amassed forces, and in 657 the two armies met at Siffin, a desolate desert area on the borders of today's Syria and Iraq. The battle swung one way and then the other. After some bloody skirmishes, Ali appeared to gain the upper hand when Muawiyah's forces were seen to call for arbitration. This they signalled by tying copies of the Quran to their lances and marching out into the battlefield. Ali, after pondering for a while, agreed to arbitration, and a council of representatives of both sides was established. Ali may have had the interests of Muslim unity at heart by accepting arbitration, but it was a disastrous political decision. Some of his own supporters were distraught. They had fought for him and seen their comrades die, believing him to be a just and legitimate caliph. And now he was allowing a council of arbitration with a rebel. For some, there should be no negotiation with the insurgents. They should be fought and quashed for their refusal to accept Ali as the leader. But Ali's willingness to negotiate was, for them, an act of treachery. They withdrew their support. Now Ali had problems on all sides. The Syrian rebels had drawn him into a lengthy arbitration process. A section of his own troops were in mutiny against him, and the momentum of his caliphate was gradually ebbing away. The arbitration process dragged on with no decisive result. Muawiyah continued as governor of Syria, and Ali's reputation as both a political and military leader was much diminished. In this situation, Ali turned to the mutineers. They were called the Khawarij, literally those who withdrew. After a concerted campaign against them, he may have prevented them from becoming a serious political threat, though they were dangerous as a guerrilla force, mounting raids on the towns of southern Iraq. Indeed, one of these Khawarij was to be Ali's assassin. In January 661, as Ali was praying in the mosque of Kufa, his Iraqi garrison town, a Khawarij agent attacked him with a poisoned sword. It took Ali 2 days to die. For the Shia, his death reduced their political program to futility. Ali had had his chance at power, and it had been a disaster. For his supporters, his downfall was the result of malevolent forces, hell-bent on frustrating the Prophet Muhammad's wishes and denying Ali's rightful leadership. He himself was, of course, not to blame. Others have seen in his actions political and military misjudgment, revealing indecision and naivete. With Ali gone, Muawiyah asserted his claim to the caliphate unchallenged, and the first dynasty of Islam, the Umayyads, ruled from Damascus. By the conventional measure of history, Ali was not a great success. He failed to assert his leadership at the Prophet's death, and when he did get his chance, he faced rebellion after rebellion. He could never command the allegiance and respect of the whole Muslim community. He made decisions, some would say foolish ones, which ultimately led to his death. He was, in truth, too preoccupied with his enemies to do any serious succession planning, and this failure meant his supporters and descendants were never to achieve the political power they claimed was theirs by right. With all this apparent mismanagement and catastrophe, it might seem puzzling that Ali was one of the most revered of the early Muslim leaders. Sunni and Shi'i alike turn to the books of his sayings for guidance and inspiration. His words are revered as not only near-perfect examples of eloquence, but also as containing the deepest, most profound spiritual understanding of Islam's message. He may not have achieved worldly greatness, but his legacy is one of near-universal respect across the Muslim world. There is an undeniable poignancy in Ali's valiant attempts to preserve his vision of the Prophet's legacy. He cuts an almost tragic figure in the early Muslim drama, and his followers and descendants formed the core of the Shi'i expression of Islam. Shi'ism, with its mourning and its sadness, its keen sense of justice and its messianic promise of liberation, traces its origins back to the heroic efforts of Ali, son of Abu Talib, cousin and son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad.